Welcome to Esoteric Excursus with E.A. Coetting. I am E.A. Coetting, author of books on practical spirituality and the occult. My most recent book is entitled Ipsissimus. Now, Ipsissimus is available for pre-order right now, and it will be hitting the bookshelves October 31st, 2011. So we just have a couple weeks to go before that comes out. I wanted to talk then about the main subject that's covered in Ipsissimus, which is soul travel, out of body experiences and astral projection. Now, let's go back to the title of the book, Ipsissimus. It literally means, you know, master of the self or the greatest self, the full self. Now, if we're to accept that there's some sort of spiritual or energetic dimension to our existence, then in order to understand the fullness of the self, we're really going to have to experiment with and study the possibilities of those other dimensions firsthand. You can get into the mental state and you look at your mind and your brain and how your brain functions. You're really not going to have a great comprehension of what you're capable of and what the brain is capable of without exercising it, without actually getting into it, without studying, and then even studying the physiology of the brain, neurotransmitters, studying how the brain actually works, and then using it, applying it. Same thing with your body. You're not going to understand how your body works until you start pushing it to the limits, until you exercise and eat healthy and eliminate toxins from your body, and then see how it operates when it has all the fuels and all the things it needs to be fully fully operational on its highest level, and then even to go the opposite route and discover how it'll operate on no food and no sleep and really just push yourself to the extremes in every direction. That's one thing I encourage. I mean, just about anybody who knows me or who's gotten into my works or has any kind of personal communication with me knows that I'm an extremist. I mean, I want to push things as far as possible and, just push the envelope, push the limits. So, when you get into the energetic states, I mean, just about everybody out there, you know, whether you're Christian or even if you're agnostic or scientific, you understand that there's an energetic dimension. Even with scientists, you'll understand that your molecules, the physical makeup of your body, also have a wavelength. And that this wavelength can actually be measured, that there's an energetic component to us as beings, and so since we're conscious of ourselves as thinking beings, as beings who are actually able to identify ourselves, to have that ipsos quality, the ego, then really we're able to look at these energetic states and go, well, let's figure out more about that. Let's discover more about who we are, what we are. So, you look at soul travel, out-of-body experiences, and astral projection. And this stuff is just popping up left and right. You know, since you had Crowley that kind of did a bit with the astral body of light, and then Israel Regardi and whatnot did, and through the 60s, 70s, 80s, it kind of got to gain momentum, and then in the last decade, we've seen just an explosion. You can't go into a bookstore without having an occult section, or a New Age section, that they call it, with books on how to astral project, and you know, easy, 10 easy steps to astral projection, and out-of-body experiences. And so it seemed like, hey, this is something that's really new, and somebody's discovered something new here. Well, none of it's new at all. These experiences of existing independent from the body, having a consciousness that can disconnect from the physical body and can travel elsewhere is actually one of the oldest spiritual techniques in known mankind and known history, and it actually forms the basis of just about every spiritual path out there. So, looking at the Upanishads, the spirit of man has two dwellings, this world and the world beyond. There is also a third dwelling place, the land of sleep and dreams. Resting in this borderland, the spirit of man can behold his dwelling in this world and in the other world afar. And wandering in the borderland, he beholds behind him the sorrows of this world, and in front of him he sees the joys of the beyond. So that, you know, that Upanishads are extraordinarily old Hindu texts, and this is talking about the fact that there's an eternal realm, and then there's the physical realm, but then there's this gulf in between, and that you can get into that gulf through your dreams and through sleep. Well, soul travel and out-of-body experiences has been called the waking sleep or waking dreams. You've got the fact that and the borderland, you know, the hinterland, the space between the eternal realms, or between the akashal and the kajal, that there's something in between that, the borderlands. That's really where you're going when you first start to soul travel. So, yeah, you can get there in dreams. If you want to access that in the most conscious way, though, you can do that through waking dreams, through waking sleep, which would be through soul travel. Now, the experience of soul travel is, you know, once again, it's something that's embedded in just about every major religion out there. You look at the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians. He said, "I swear, brothers in Christ, that I die daily." Now, Paul was an interesting character, and by this, you know, it's really easy to, when you put that one sentence, "I swear, brothers in Christ, that I die daily," if you put that one sentence in the context of everything else Paul said, it's obvious that he meant that the afterlife and the spirit world holds no mystery for him, because he visits those realms beyond the flesh on a daily basis. And, you know, that's really an amazing thing. Now, what's interesting to notice is that the Christian church was built on the example of Peter. And that's, you know, specifically Catholicism is built on the example of Peter. But the actual words of Christ immediately after his death were carried to the world by Paul, by the Apostle Paul. So it's built on the example of Peter, but built on the words of Paul and the teachings of Paul. Now, Paul said, a lot of times when he was opening up his letters, he would say, "I am absent from you, but with you in spirit." And he would say, "I am not with you, but," and then he would go on to tell them exactly what they were what was going on in their community, in their society, what kind of faults they had, what kind of things they needed to overcome. And now, this was not in an era of Facebook and instant messaging and text messages. This was in an era where it would take days, weeks, months for word to get from one place to another. So he was somehow seeing what was going on in these other places where he had these churches set up. So that was another telling thing. Now, he goes on to say, I knew a man in Christ 14 years ago, and then says, "Whether I was in the body or out of the body, I know not. God knows. Such a one caught up into the third heaven." Now, there is this common thing when people get into soul travel, especially if it's spontaneous and they're not sitting down with the intention of it, they'll be praying or meditating or doing something, and all of a sudden, boom, they're out of their body and they go, they're somewhere else, and it'll be such a real experience, such a fully involved experience, that they'll really have a hard time telling whether their body is with them or if they've left their body. And logic would obviously tell them, well, I'm in some place that's not Earth, this is not a physical place, ergo my body is not with me. But really, I think when you're in that state, it's such a fully integrated experience that differentiation is really hard to make, and that's that is kind of the what you can expect with soul travel, is that it'll be such a real experience that at first there are stages. At first it'll seem imaginative, and then later on it'll seem fully integrated, where you feel like your body is right there with you, and then it'll get to the point where the reality outside of the body, the spiritual reality, seems more real, more connected, more tangible than this physical body and this physical experience. And so that's a really interesting and telling thing that Paul would say there, that whether I was in the body or out of the body, I know not. Now, also, Meher Baba says, one can, at will, put on and take off the external gross body as if it were a cloak, and use the astral body for experiencing the inner world of the astral and for undertaking journeys through it, if and when necessary. The ability to undertake astral journeys, therefore, involves considerable expansion of one's scope for experience. It brings opportunities for promoting one's own spiritual advancement, which begins with the involution of consciousness. So, that really brings it back full circle as to, if we want to really get into what and who we are as a species, if we really want to get into to what we are as human beings, we need to get into to the deepest. We need to access the deepest parts of our consciousness, and then, do an involution, a going inwards, and then an extra evolution, a moving outward. So, a collapse of the consciousness, infinitely within, and at the same time infinitely without, and really pushing yourself beyond boundaries. You'll also notice, because I did say this is some of the oldest stuff, but I'm giving some modern examples. I'm only going back a few thousand years, for God's sake. But then you look back, 6,000-7,000 BC, you look at the Sumerians. They would have special gateways and hidden locations throughout the cities, specifically in Babylon, where they could they could sit or go into these areas and then leave their bodies and go into the land of the dead. The Mayan also had experiences with the vision serpent. Almost all of the Mayan practices, spiritual practices, were intended to release the spirit from the body and put it on the black road to Xibalba, where you could enter the land of the dead and then come back. So soul travel has been around since basically man has started experimenting with and experiencing his own spirituality. All right, so let's talk a bit about the Theta Gamma Sync. Now, why this is important at all, this Theta Gamma Sync, and I, for the past couple of years, I've been really hammering on this, that all ritual, all spiritual experiences need to be linked up to this Theta Gamma Sync. And as I was researching my book, Questing After Visions, that I put out a few years ago, as I was researching for that book, I came across some really interesting science that linked up with the knowledge that I already had, the understanding I had about spirituality, and that was really interesting, because I've kind of got the saying that I'm always telling people, which is that science is only now, and this is, I mean, even fringe science and the most wacky science is only now catching up to what prophets and seers and magicians and sorcerers have been saying for millennia. And you know, mainstream science is starting to catch on to some of this. It starts out as a fringe science, and the wackos out there will start to tinker with it, and then it'll catch on, and before you know it, everyone's going, wait a minute, that everything has a particulate and a wave state. What does this mean? Oh, that we're not completely solid beings, that nothing around us is completely solid, that everything is completely subjective. I mean, these are things that have been taught in metaphysics, in the esoteric, for millennia. This is what we have understood, but science is starting to connect the dots with their assumptions and their mathematics. So, you know, looking at questing after visions, the human brain switches between several different states of brainwave activity. The beta signature of brainwave activity, running between 14 to 30 hertz, is reached during concentration, thinking, problem solving, analyzing information, etc. The higher beta range, which runs about between 30 to 40 hertz, is where a good deal of people's brainwaves remain during daily work and life. Now, as you drop, as your brainwaves drop to between 25 and 14 hertz, that's when you start relaxing your tension. You might turn on the TV, you might be reading a relaxing book and start kind of drifting off, daydreaming, you know, whatever. It's where you're relaxing. You're not really consciously actively engaged. And then, you know, that's where you'll start preparing to enter the alpha state. Now, the alpha states of brainwave activity, which are between 7 to 12 hertz, those are reached during complete relaxation, creativity, thoughtfulness, and not when I say creativity, not where you're focused intensely on what you're trying to create, but more when if you've ever painted, when you paint and your mind just leaves you, you're not thinking, you're just moving the brush, things like that, where you're not actively engaging the mathematical part of your brain, you'll be in the alpha brainwave state. Now, so you know, that'll be artistic trance, daydreaming, and anything that even back to TV watching. If you're watching TV but you're not really paying attention, you're just kind of tranced out, which is one reason I don't watch television is that I just trance out. So there are a few shows that I'll catch on the net, but if I turn on the TV, that's what I do. I trance out. So, you know, for anybody who's a TV addict, you know very well what the alpha brainwave state is like. So that'll bring us, you know, to a point where, you know, alpha starts running really, really, really close to a deep relaxation, meditation, or sleep, but not quite there. Theta waves, which run between 4 to 7 hertz, are only found during deep meditation, the hypnagogia that precedes actual sleep, and some drug-induced stupors, which you'll use if you've used opiates, amphetamines, absinthe. I can't think of any others right offhand. Cocaine use will do the same, but you have to use these things beyond the point where your serotonin levels are spiked. When your serotonin levels drop, your dopamine levels drop, and you kind of enter that, you know, the dope goggles, where you're not really focused on much anything. You're just tranced out. Obviously, I would recommend getting into to meditation or relaxation or even sleep before I'd suggest turning to chemicals to get you to the theta state, because it's going to be completely uncontrolled. You're not going to be able to hold it, and that's the key, is to be able to hold the theta state. Now, just underneath the theta state is the delta sleep, and that's black sleep. That's 0 to 4 hertz. Really, most people will go into the theta state as they're falling asleep, and then drop into delta sleep pretty quickly. And even if you're meditating, so many people that first start meditating say that they start meditating, then they fall asleep, and that's a problem that they encounter. Well, that's basically because you've trained your mind that theta is not really a place that you hang out. Theta is just like you pass through that before, on your way to sleep. You don't want to, you know, hang around there. And so that's something that you gotta kind of train yourself where theta is actually where you want to be. That is the ideal brainwave state. People who are in theta, who aren't actively engaging their minds, but are in complete relaxation, complete thoughtlessness, actually find that that's when they're able to do a lot of problem solving. Where if you have any kind of problem that you're trying to find a solution to in your daily life, if you enter into the theta state and you stay there, that solution just comes to you. I mean, we've all had the experience of you know, racking our brains to try to figure out something with work and finances or our relationships, and we can't get it. But then as soon as we lay down and drift into the theta state, we wake up and go, "Oh, I've got it!" And that, you know, that theta state is just the perfect mental decompression chamber where you're not crashing all these thoughts into each other. Everything just flows effortlessly in theta. So now, what's interesting is that there's another level that's even deeper than theta. It's deeper than sleep, deeper than unconsciousness. Yet it's more alert than the highest beta currents. So, I'm just to read directly from Questing After Visions here in front of me. As the subject perseveres through the silence of the theta state, a door will be opened more like a portal to the gamma brainwave state. While the exact measurement of gamma brainwaves seems to overlap into high beta activity, true gamma states are agreed to begin around 40 hertz. So, to give you a synopsis there, once again, beta would cap out at 40. So if you go above 40, you're beyond beta and you're into gamma. Initially, researchers believe that gamma waves in the human brain only stretched about as far as 70 hertz. But new studies are beginning to show subjects producing up to 20 hertz of gamma waves. The study of gamma waves in the human brain is in its infancy as far as the exploration of the areas of human cognition. The production of waves themselves in higher vibrations, 70 hertz and above, appear to coincide with supposed precognitive and other extrasensory abilities. It is in this state that the illusory world begins to peel away at its finest cracks to reveal an eternal reality. So, you know, if you're looking at this, and this has been an amazing experience for me to be able to look at the science of it, but then to connect it back to the practical application. I mean, I started learning yoga. You know, not the yoga that you do at your local athletic club, but actual meditative yoga, you know, Raja yoga and Saivistic yoga. You know, I started learning all that when I was an early teenager and started getting into the occult and the manipulation of physiology and psychology in order to achieve these amazing brainwave states really early on. And then I, you know, here, and when I think I was 28 when I was writing Questing After Visions. And so at 28, I start connecting the dots and going, wait a minute, wait, there's the science is backing this up. But it would be really difficult just to rely on the science alone. I think that it's something that you have to trigger in yourself. You have to make the physiological and psychological trigger. And once you trigger the theta gamma sync in yourself, it's gonna flow. You're gonna be able to trigger it again and again and again, faster and faster and faster. You should be able to trigger the theta gamma sync pretty quickly. Now, the best way to trigger that I've found, just because it's the way that I learned how to trigger it, is by looking at people's auras. And I discussed this on the last podcast I did last week. But if you gaze at somebody's aura, you want to put them a bit of a distance away from you. It helps if they don't know that you're seeing the aura, because then it gets kind of awkward, and they're staring at you while you're staring at them, and it distracts everybody, and you just giggle, and you don't really get the exercise. So, I used to do this in church when I was a kid, and you can go ahead and you can go to church, you can go to your city council meeting, go somewhere where one person will be standing up and you'll be able to focus on them, and it's not going to be unusual for you to be staring at that person. They want to be stared at, so take advantage of that. So you're going to let your eyes just kind of drift. You're going to let your gaze drift. It's a lot like those three-dimensional pictures where it looks like a bunch of color. You bring it close to your face, and then as you pull it away, you let your eyes just continue to be relaxed, and then you get a certain distance away, and boom, a 3D picture pops out at you. It appears to pop out at you. It's a whole optical illusion thing. And so it's a lot like looking at one of those where you just unfocus your vision. You don't want to stare too hard. I've found that if you look in the person's eyes, then it'll kind of trigger itself, and you'll see light just expand from that person. It'll form a shell around them, and at first it'll be golden, and then it'll start changing colors. What's interesting is that as you start looking at it, while it's golden still, before you start seeing it change colors, you're going to feel like a complete loss of equilibrium. You feel like you're doubling over yourself, like you're spinning in space. And then you'll feel like as if the ground has just dropped out beneath you, and you'll feel your feet dip forward into the ground. You'll feel yourself tumbling. But at the same time, visually, you can see that you're still in the church or area or wherever you're at. You're still there. You can see it. And so what's changed is your proprioception, your ability to know where you're at in space through your basic sensations and your equilibrium. So that can trigger the theta gamma sync. Go ahead and try that and look at somebody's aura and just get into that state until you feel yourself doing that tumbling into space, until you feel yourself falling through rings of reality. And that's going to be essential, not just for learning how to soul travel, learning how to see auras, but I mean for anything that you're doing with the occult. If you get yourself into the theta gamma sync as you're going through the exercise, as you're going through the discipline, it's going to make all the difference in the world. It's going to make the difference between success and failure, really. So, I want to talk about that was kind of how to engage the theta gamma sync and what the theta gamma sync is. And I hope I've explained that with some clarity, so you can kind of take that and hopefully run with it. I do want to get into what I mean by soul travel. What is that? I want to differentiate as well between soul travel and astral travel. So let's talk for a second about the different phases of existence, of energetic and even beyond energetic, but formed existence, where you've got you can see, I like to see all of creation as concentric circles, and that you have a source in really concentric spheres, but a sphere is kind of harder to imagine than a two-dimensional circle. But you have a central source from which all things emanate, and that's light and sound, bursting out of this and flowing. Now, as the light and sound move farther away from that central source, it densifies. It goes through a condensation where it becomes denser and denser, more and more concrete. And those layers of densification can be seen, basically are what we measure as being the different planes or realms. And so the first one that you'll reach, well, you've got what's called the soul plane. You've got the soul plane. You've got the God planes, and those are really highly debatable, because you know not that many people who go there talk about it. Even in Abscissimus, I hinted it a lot, but there is so much that you'll experience in the soul planes and the God planes that can never be put to words. And there's a reason that people, when they reach a certain stage of their progress, completely withdraw from, you know, human society, or they withdraw from their role as spiritual gurus or mentors of any sort, because they just can no longer put into words what they've experienced. And and that does tie directly into their experience of the soul planes and the God planes. And but there are levels of extreme experience that you still can put to words, that I still try to put to words, and I'm actually going to read you later on in this podcast an excerpt from Abscissimus where I discuss one of those. But as the light and sound, and I'm borrowing some of these terms from Paul Twitchell's Vision of Ekankar, and also from some different Hindu texts, and some modern interpretations of the Bhagavad Gita. You know, I'm kind of pulling from everywhere, and so I don't want you to listen to this or to get into it and go, wait a minute, this sounds a lot like this weird dude that was talking about this stuff in the 60s. Well, I'm just borrowing the vocabulary and matching that up with the experiences I've had. Because, you know, once again, a lot of this is really difficult to put into a unique wording, and so I am borrowing, you know, the term soul travel does come from specifically Ekankar, so I don't want that to throw you off at all, but okay, so you've got as this light and sound travels away from the source, it densifies. The first plane, the first realm that you can really see where it really densifies to such a degree that it causes basically a barrier, would be the formative plane. And in the formative plane, basically that's where everything, all this light, this sound, this power, all of this gains intention, and that intention flows down into the worlds outside of that, below that, and starts becoming manifestation. Before that, it's just pure, it's basically pure power. And then the formative plane, as things are passing, it actually passes through an abyss. And this is, Crowley talked a lot about the abyss, and a lot of more modern occult authors talk about the abyss. And it's a realm that you would have to cross over through before you get to the real realms of spirituality. And that is very true. And then you'll have the mental plane, the causal plane, the astral plane, and the physical double. And then the physical plane. Now, the astral plane, and I put in physical double because it's not necessarily an exact replica of this world. It's what I called in some of my early works Spiritus Regnum, or Regnum Spiritus. I kind of, those were easily juxtaposed. So, and then the physical plane. And so basically, as this power flows out from its central source, it gets more and more dense until it gets completely dense, which is physical existence. It doesn't get any denser than it is here. Now, so so uh, So that's basically how I see it. Now, you can take that model and you can use it or you can completely discard it. It really doesn't matter. This is just how I see it and how I like to explain it and how it makes the most sense for me. And you know, I've soul traveled to all of these different realms, and I've gone further than that. And so, you know, in my experiences, I've gone, okay, well, this makes sense. And I've taken some of these terms, some of this vocabulary, and these maps of cosmology from these different sources, and I've discarded a lot of it, and then kind of taken it and picked apart, oh, that makes sense, and then formed, you know, my own little layout. It works for me. It might not work for you. You might discover that there are realms in between, or that you can merge a few of them. It really doesn't matter. It's your journey. You do what you want with it. So, when you're soul traveling, the main difference is that from this whole map, and most mystics and occultists will agree with me that you have the physical plane, immediately followed by the astral plane, immediately followed by the causal plane, immediately followed by the mental plane. That's pretty much a general layout. And so the astral plane is just one step closer to the source of things than the physical plane. If you astral project, if you solidify an astral body of light and use that to project yourself, you're going to get into the astral plane, and that's about it. You really are going to have a hard time going much further. Having an astral body of light also, I think, focuses a little too much on the mechanism rather than the intention. I think that it's better to focus on what your actual intention is rather than, you know, if I'm working on my car, which, you know, I do a lot, I'll grab, you know, a wrench and start working on it. Sometimes I won't have a wrench, and so I'll grab a pair of pliers and do my best to work that, make that work, and grab whatever I've got on hand, because my intention is to fix the car or to improve the car somehow. My intention isn't to look at this wrench and really analyze the wrench and get to know the wrench and feel the wrench in my hands. I mean, yeah, I guess if you've got nothing but time on your hands, that can be fun to do for somebody, not for me. What I want to do is fix the freaking car. So in this way, soul travel approaches the whole subject a lot more directly. You're not dealing with a lot of these mental games that people play to get themselves into astral project. You're not building up an astral double. You are sitting down and you are soul traveling. You're leaving your body. And basically, how to soul travel. That's what everybody's kind of waiting for. How to soul travel. Well, okay, that's great and all, but how do I freaking do this? And you know, I'm going to give you a brief synopsis. I do go over this in quite a bit of depth in Obsessimus. And so, you know, it's going to be hard for me to summarize this in an hour-long podcast and be able to give you all the information that you need. It is all in Obsessimus. Once again, you can pick that up at Lila Publications, and that's www.lila.org. O-R-G. LEILAH.org. You pick that up on the 31st. You can pre-order it or whatever, because this book is going to have so much more than what I could put into this podcast. I do want to kind of outline this so you have an idea of what to do, and a good deal of y'all who are going to be able to take this and go home and soul travel today. And then when you buy Obsessimus, when you get it in your hands and you're reading it, it's going to connect the dots for you even more. So basically, there are a lot of these games that people will play to get themselves to project, where they'll envision a rose in front of them, and then they'll envision that they are the rose, and then supposedly they're going to pop out their body as soon as they become the rose. When I was 14, 15, I knew this girl who's said her grandma could astral project, and all she would have to do is think about a person or a place without using any words, and as soon as her vision became completely wordless, she would just pop out of her body, and there she was with that person. There are exercises of visualizing that a rope comes down and that you grab the rope with your astral arms and you pull yourself out and then boop, you're out of your body. I never had much luck with those until after I learned how to soul travel. After I learned how to soul travel, then they were silly. But, you know, I don't. Once again, I think that's extremely limiting to use those rather than just attacking the whole thing directly. And so, how to attack that directly? You're gonna sit in your chair, and I'm gonna go through this. I'm gonna actually do a little soul travel here, and it'll be an interesting experience. So you're gonna sit in your chair. You're gonna relax your body. Relax your shoulders, your head, kind of, you know, I've got a lot of tenseness in my muscles, so I'm going to have to relax those, and, you know, I'll pop my neck and my back and just kind of get myself all relaxed, and then I'll notice, you know, as my muscles relax more, I'll have bones and joints that just automatically kind of start cracking and whatever, so just get yourself completely relaxed. Let whatever bones need to be crack, and let your muscles just relax, and your joints just kind of separate just a tiny bit. And even let your chin drop onto your chest. Let your eyelids, especially pay attention to your forehead and your eyelids. You don't want, you know, when people get really tense in their forehead and their eyes. And you want to kind of pay attention to that, make sure that those are relaxed. And then bring your attention to your breath. I don't want you to count your breaths. I don't think counting breaths is good. It engages the beta state a little too much. I want you to get into the theta state. If you're thinking about it, if you're counting your breaths, you're missing it. So just get into the breath. Just breathe. And then breathe out. And it's going to be a relaxing breath. Deep, deep breaths and relaxing. And as you do this, just let you're going to actually just let your brainwaves sink and sink and sink. And if you've already done the exercise of seeing auras and getting into the theta gamma sink, this should be pretty easy for you to get back there. So you're going to start triggering that until you get into the same spot, where you start to feel that loss of equilibrium, you start to feel like the floor just drops out underneath you. And that's where I'm at. My eyes are closed now, and my body's completely relaxed, and I'm in the theta gamma sink. Now, what's also happened at this point, my lips are moving so I can keep talking into this microphone, but my eyes are closed, and my whole body is starting to feel numb. And when you sleep, your body goes into sleep paralysis. It's completely normal, completely natural. It's a way for your body to basically just freeze itself so it's not reacting to the mental stimuli that's going on in your head while you're dreaming. So your body kind of does something very similar when you start to enter the theta state, when you hold the theta state, where your body will almost get into this paralysis. And you're just going to let it drift there, and you're going to find that, you know, you're going to twitch every now and again. That's okay. You're not trying to hold still. I mean, you're not trying to do a complete bodhisattva meditation. All you're trying to do is relax and get your brainwaves into theta. And my brainwaves are into theta, and so what you're going to do then is see the room around you. With your eyes closed, you're going to look at the room around you. You're going to notice in the theta gamma sink that it looks quite a bit like it would look if your eyes were open, to the point that the lighting looks the same, shadows are cast in the same way. You're going to be startled by the clarity that you have, the clear vision that you can have even with your eyes closed. Now, once you've got that, I want you to pick an object in your room. Now, I'm going to have to swivel my chair, kind of pull myself out of the theta gamma sink, just a tiny bit to swivel my chair, because I'm sitting right next to my computer, so I'm going to face my door. So I'm facing my door, getting back into the theta gamma sink, dropping my brainwave states, And I can see my room again. So you want to see the room that you're in. And you're still breathing. Hopefully, if you're not breathing still, then there's an issue. So you need to just let your breath be relaxing. And then as you exhale, I want you to move towards the door or towards whatever object it is you've chosen. You can choose a chair, a lamp, it doesn't matter. But breathe in, and as you breathe out, move towards the door. Now, that's hard to keep talking while I'm not in my body. When you move, give me a second. Wow. Okay, when you move, you're gonna move with your breath, and so you'll move, and then your whole vision of your room and your position is going to change, obviously. And so at first it's going to be visual. At first it's going to be something that you see. And you're only going to be able to get out just long enough to go to that spot. Or maybe even get halfway there, depending on how quickly you breathe back in. Because as soon as you breathe back in, all of your energy comes back to yourself. You can feel this if you sit there and you can feel your energy, you can feel your aura. And as you breathe in, you can feel all of your energy kind of constrict inside of yourself and pull inside. And then you breathe out and you can push it out. And so it's very much the same. You breathe out and you can push yourself away from your body. Then you breathe in, it automatically sucks you back. And so it takes some effort to be able to get to that object across the room. And then as you breathe in, to stabilize yourself. You basically have to like plant your spiritual feet into the ground, and then as you breathe in, you feel that you're basically going to reverse the feed. That normally your breaths would control where your spiritual body is in relation to your physical body. You're going to kind of reverse that a bit, where your breaths will activate your spiritual body as if it's your physical body. So what that's going to do is basically it's going to solidify your spiritual body. And so as your physical body breathes in, your spiritual body is going to become more illuminated. And it's going to pull more of that power into itself, more of that energy into itself. And that's kind of a battle that you need to fight with yourself, with your own experience. I don't think that if you're able to get into the theta gamma sink, if you're able to see room clearly, that getting out of your body these first couple times isn't going to be very difficult. It's going to be pretty easy. The biggest issue, I think, is going to be holding yourself outside of your body. Getting out's not the hard part. It's holding yourself out, staying outside. Now, once you've gotten that down where your inhalations no longer pull you back into your physical body, but instead they solidify where you're at spiritually, then where your spiritual body's at, then it's basically you go where you want. Now, most people are going to want to go around this world and go peep in on people in the shower or whatever it is that you do, or go see what's going on with your friends or your parents or whatever it is you want to see in this world that you wish you could be invisible to go be a fly on the wall. And, that's fun and all that. And experiment with that for sure. Now, at first, again, it's going to be visual. What you want to do as part of your practice is to get to that other spot. So project, if you're just projecting across the room or, across the world, you want to get to that spot and then start including all of your other senses. So, you've got your five senses, obviously. So you're seeing it. You're able to see it. And at first it's going to seem imaginative. It's going to seem like, I could just be making this up. I could just be imagining this with a lot more clarity of imagination than you've ever had before. But then you'll be able to sometimes be able to verify the information or kind of test it. If you go with it and really don't have that, well, I'm going to come back and see if it's true. I had a friend who, or a student who, projected himself across the island that he lived on to his brother's house, and his brother would put out a can of canned food out on the table. He would project to his brother's house and see if he could identify the can of food. So then he would come back to his body, call his brother, and he was wrong every time. Well, there's time shifts there. I mean, he could have been seeing the can that was going to be placed 10 minutes from then or a day from then. I had another of my students project to me. I used to do that with the students I would have in the autosensometrinalis. I'd have them project to me and then just give me a report about what my apartment looks like or what they saw with myself or my, you know, my ex-wife or my daughter. I had one project here and described in perfect detail my friend. And my friend Casey. And my friend Casey hadn't been over for quite a while, so I wasn't sure why he was seeing that, and I thought, well, obviously a failure. And then as I'm actually reading his report, because he emailed me his report, he was, I believe, from Australia. He emailed me his report, so I'm reading over it, and I'm going, well, it's obviously a failure. And in that exact moment, Casey came, knocked on the door. I answer. He's wearing the exact same clothes. It's included in the report that my friend sent, that my student sent me. So it aligned in a kind of a spooky, eerie way in that moment. But he wasn't seeing what was happening real time, and so verification of soul travel is difficult if you're looking for that kind of proof. Now, what you will have is you'll have verification of things, because you will see things that are happening, going to happen in the future. You'll also see things that happened quite in the distant past, and you'll be able to get information about that. Even more interesting, though, is when you get outside the physical plane altogether, which you can definitely do. You get outside the physical plane, go into the astral plane, where everything is energy and spirit and power. And emotion, a lot of emotion in the astral plane. And you can go there and you can experience that. And there are temples that exist on these planes where you can meet with spiritual masters, with ascended masters, with masters that and gurus that are alive now. Will have an astral double in these temples, that'll also exist in the causal and the mental planes, so. What's really interesting is when you start going into these temples, and really once you focus your mind on it, if you want to get to the astral plane from here, from the physical plane, you can do that through gateways. You can find little portals that are open. You just basically look out and just fix that intention as you're in a soul traveled state. You fix the intention of, I want to go to a temple on the astral plane, and then you'll see a bright light that you can just head towards. Boom, you enter this portal, and next thing you know, you're in the astral plane in this temple, and then you can go through those experiences, and then those masters will be like, hey, well, you've learned all you can here, let's take you to the causal plane. So blip, you're there. And you can really just kind of bounce all over the place, and that's really cool, really fun. But then you'll learn things, and they'll read to you from these, or they'll show you these scriptures, for lack of a better word. I guess since we're all occulty, we could call them grimoires, but scriptures, grimoires, whatever. You open them up, and it's just pure light. You know, there's no real words on the astral plane. There are, but not on the mental plane or above. But you open it, and it's pure light, and this light floods through you, and you have the words that would otherwise be written on the pages just flooding through your mind. And then you come back, and you'll hear those exact same words repeated by somebody, or you'll see it in a book, or you'll read it in a scripture, or in a grimoire, and it's really an interesting validation of these things. In a lot of ways, our spiritual experimentations are set up to have some kind of internal self-validation, because you'll almost always see validation of your rituals, of your manifestations, and of your learnings in the external world. Just kind of the alignment of consciousness, I guess a lot of people would chalk it up to. So as you bring your other senses into wherever you're at, you're going to obviously be seeing it, and it's going to seem quite imaginative. But then you're going to bring your hearing into it and really see, okay, well, what does this hear? What does this sound like? What am I picking up in the pressure that's around your spiritual ears? And then you can bring your sense of touch as well, where you can reach out your spiritual hands and touch whatever's around you. You can feel it, and then taste and smell, and then your what's really important is your proprioception, to get your full proprioception to that spot where. You know, if you have, and that's really the breaking point when this becomes a very, very real, where you can get your five senses there, you can have all of your five senses engaged, but it'll still be imaginative. But then you completely transfer your proprioception to that spot, and you no longer, you'll have that experience like Paul did, where you say, well, I didn't know if I was in my body or out. Only God knows, because this is nuts. That's really the point where you want to be at and get to is to completely transfer your proprioception to that spot. Proprioception, I don't know if I defined this earlier, is basically your ability to know where you're at in your environment, basically by your equilibrium, by the interaction of all of your senses on a subconscious level. So you can engage your senses consciously, and that's cool, but it's going to be imaginative until you bring your proprioception along for the ride, and then it'll become very real. Briefly tell you, I'm kind of running a bit, I'm about to start running a bit longer than I anticipated, but that's okay. The experience I had is I was standing up on a balcony, a three-story balcony at the top of our town. I live in a valley. This was several years ago. I was 20 years old, so 10 years ago, and maybe more than that. I don't remember now. Maybe I was 18. But anyways, I'm on a balcony, and I'm looking down at the town, and it's an October morning, and so it's there's some fog that's kind of rolling through the streets, and it's a kind of crisp coolness in the air, and I see a spot that just caught my attention for some reason, that's on cross streets. And mind you, this is probably a good 10-15 miles away from where I was standing. And as I breathed out, I basically just instantly, my whole self just jumped towards that spot. And all of a sudden, I realized I was at that spot on the street 10-15 miles away, rather than in my body. And so I kind of looked around, and I had projected so many times with my senses, but that was the first time I had fully projected, where I felt like my physical body had just completely teleported to this place. And then I came back to myself. As soon as I breathed back in, boom, I'm back in my body. And then I kind of experimented with that a few times, jumping in and out, and going, wow, this is kind of nuts, because it made the whole thing kind of clicked. And it basically will get to that point that there's no real way that I can tell you to bring your proprioception along for the ride, aside from repeated practice of soul travel, of getting your all of your senses to operate in a location that's not where your body's at, and once you get get into that and get the feel of it, and your senses get more and more engaged, it's natural that your proprioception is going to center and be centered in that spiritual body rather than the physical body. And at that point, basically the transfer is complete. And at that point, you can start going through all these different realms. You can start the actual process of conscious ascent through the planes. Now, I did want to read kind of as a closing note here from Ipsissimus. I just wanted to give you a little taste of what this book is going to have in it. And this is a discussion where I said, you know, we can we can get into these states and these planes that are far beyond what you might think imaginable. So this is from chapter 6, which is entitled the Third Tier. The mind is the greatest enemy of the seeker after truth. Both mind and truth must be sacrificed at the edge of the Black River to gain entrance into that which is real, that which exists outside of Maya. Thought is the interpretation of anything whatsoever. Facilitated by the mind, all interpretations relying on experiences gained not in any real circumstances, but gained instead in the world of falsehood created in a large part by the mind itself. Mind cannot be trusted. It cannot be relied on to provide anything accurate, usable, or even pertinent. The great abyss that separates the realms of soul from the worlds of Maya is the chaos of wrenching control away from the mind and its millions of faulty calculations, and turning such awareness over to the experience itself. Likewise, truth cannot be trusted, as it is as subjective. Likewise, truth cannot be trusted, as it is a subjective knowledge based on the aforementioned erroneous analysis of experience. I spent some time in the abyss. In the moment of my projection from my physical body, I would find myself there, and the abyss followed me back through the silver cord to the earth, infesting my life with hopelessness. I had undergone a series of dark nights of the soul, and this period was chief among them. Yet I persisted, sure that if I traveled to the other worlds, I would find a doorway out of the abyss, or the grace of some spiritual master or another would release me, like Virgil, allowing me to suffer in hell only long enough to more surely appreciate heaven. No door was found, but instead a transformation, a transfiguration, in an instant passing through the abyss into the next world, into the next sphere, closer to the source. I closed my eyes, fixed my mind on the other worlds, and I jumped. Rather than falling back into the blackness of outer darkness to be surrounded by impenetrable sorrow, I was instead soaring through liquid light. So fast was my ascent that my ethereal skin burned, but I could not slow my flight. I could feel it tearing away from me like flesh from bones in Hiroshima. The sobbing that seemed to be made by the darkness of the abyss itself was replaced by the sound of fierce screaming, as a starving infant at a dead mother's breast. I was horrified and longed for the solace of that black and hopeless perdition again, but my ascent could not be slowed. I looked out, my three burning eyes, but insistent upon finding that a shrieking babe, I saw only the liquid light, like a rampant river of living paint, which passed through me as I flew. As the last remains of my form were torn from me, like skin from muscle and muscle from bone, I realized that the screaming was coming from within myself. I was the babe, and indeed my mother had died, and the breast of life and identity and relation had withered under my incessant sucking. Like a suicide jumper growing quietly comfortable with the previous rush of the fall, a split second before impact, the momentum of my flight was no longer startling, but instead I was able to observe it quite spectacularly. I was not flying upwards, nor was I plummeting down. I did not move from side to side. Instead, it was as if I was turning inside out, and at the same time expanding myself beyond myself, at such a rate to defy any conventional explanation of speed. And the thought came clearly, I have no more form. What then am I? Myself having been stripped from me, what can identity be but pure power, unfettered by shape, thought, or even mind? I looked again around at the rushing river of color, and there was no separation. I was not an object in the river, a boulder around which the waters parted, but I was the liquid light itself. And I flowed down, as light and sound, to the lower planes, revisiting the worlds that I had traveled from, not descending into those lower forms, but delivering the light and the power of myself to them, as the light and power of the Eternal is delivered constantly. And as if by an inhalation from that realm of light itself, I was drawn back up into the gulf of liquid light, and with eyes that did not exist, I beheld the center of that world, a torso larger than I could fathom, arms outstretched, becoming the light, waist flowing down, becoming the light, hair and eyes and skin becoming that liquid light. From this single embodiment on that plane, all of the power of the Eternal flowed into the lower worlds, spurring into motion the quantum and the universal shifts that create form on the various planes of condensation. My attention returned to myself, and I found that I was shrieking once more, wailing for my mother, the physical plane, the earth and the body that hung limp, waiting for me. My eyes shot open and I gasped for air, as if I hadn't tasted it for days, as if I had crawled out of a subterranean crypt and needed to feed my resurrected lungs. Before I could think to slowly reawaken my body to this world, I was standing, bolted up from the chair like it was rigged to a car battery, jump-starting my heart. It took me several minutes of thrashing and gasping, slobbering on the carpeted floor and covering my eyes, burning from the daylight before I was even able to recognize that I had returned to my body. I looked at the clock. I had been in that other place for so long, at least hours if not longer. I had traveled further than any measurement of distance could calculate, beyond not only the reach of this universe, but beyond the reach of even thought itself. I had become the sea of creative flame, of which and through which all things are created, and I had beheld the single embodiment on that plane. I had participated in the simultaneous acts of creation, sustenance, and destruction in the lower worlds, and rose again as that juggernaut creator inhaled. Only 2 minutes had elapsed. This is E.A. Coetting with Esoteric Excursus. Yeah, I just read that from my forthcoming book, Ipsissimus. Give a shameless plug, you know, of all the books I've written, and this will be the seventh book in my series of published works. This will be the seventh book published of all of them. This is the best. I mean, this one, I read through it, and I just want to share it. I have to share it. I have to get it out there. I have to take it and run around and say, look at this, it's amazing. This book will be one of the major defining moments in my career as a writer and as a spiritual teacher and a guide. And you know, I've given you about an hour and some minutes of a summary of everything that I kind of get into in Ipsissimus, where I get into soul travel. I talk about soul travel and my experiences with it, and how you can have those experiences, how you can take this and maybe discover a completely different cosmos and different spiritual existence than what I have. But I'm sure that if we were to sit down and compare notes, we would be talking about the same thing, but just in a different vocabulary. So, you know, to bring this back full circle, when, you know, at the start of this whole podcast, is that that in order to understand ourselves, in order to really get into who we are and what we are as human beings, we need to fully engage ourselves in understanding our energetic states, in understanding our spiritual states, because that's as intrinsically a part of ourselves as anything else that we do or that we are and that we experience. And once again, you know, we're science is catching on to this, that we're not just physical bodies, we're not just a lump of molecules, that there is so much more to us. And through these most ancient techniques, we can actively engage in discovering what that else is, and I get into that deeply in Obsessimus, and that is why I do feel like this book is possibly the most important book that I have ever and will ever write. You know, just because of answering those questions and then asking more questions and then leading you to be able to get your own answers you know, it's really amazing. So, you know, if you're able to go to Leila.org, and that's LEILAH.org, or to Barnes and Noble and pre-order the book Obsessimus by E.A. Coetting. It's an amazing book, and then October 31st, pick it up. You can even just wait till October 31st and order it or buy it at, you know, wherever. And more than that, though, more than just buying the book, more than just trying to sell the book, I want you to have these experiences. I want, you know, my dream is to have, if one third of the population of this earth were to become actively engaged in discovering their true identity as spiritual beings, that we would far transcend any of the issues. Nothing that we're concerned about today would even be an issue. Nothing that really bothers humankind would even be on the table anymore. Within minutes, that one third of the population of the earth could change everything. And so, you know, I think that if we can get the people who are interested right now, who are listening to this podcast and who are reading my books and who are reading, you know, books of these other people who are saying some of the same things, who are kind of leading up to what I'm finally releasing in this book, which really hasn't really ever come out. Everyone's kind of hinting at it, and then I put this book together and said, well, I'm done hinting. I'm done with the foreplay. Let's get to the real thing here. And the real thing really is that we can get into conscious contact, not necessarily with other spirits and spiritual masters, and those are just routes, those are just tools. And what you're really getting in contact with is your true identity, what you really are at the core. And so, you know, if I can help get some of the people who are interested in uncovering that, to offer them the experiences that I've had and the tools to hopefully do that, I think that we can, you know, I'm not all about just saving the earth. I'm not going to go that extreme hippie route at this point, but I think that we can make changes that are very essential. And not that we all need to band together as you know, Jedi Knights and go, you know, make things perfect, but in our own lives, to make our own lives perfect, and to look at what we know about ourselves, and for our own knowledge of ourselves to become perfected. That's really where it's going towards. You know, you have a million rivers, and they all converge into the same sea, and that's really the point of it all. So, on that note, this is E.A. Coetting with Esoteric Excursus. I thank you for bearing with me.